Join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club in October, and we'll send you a limited edition Here I Stand t-shirt. Find out more about our monthly or annual giving program at issuesetc.org. Just click the picture of Martin Luther posting the 95 Theses, or call Craig 618-223-8385. Join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club by Reformation Day, and we'll send you a limited edition long sleeve shirt along with your other membership benefits. The Issues Etc. Reformation Club.
But you know, we have our Christian conservatives for Trump today, and they're in the room. Let's go.
Do I think that if somebody uses the phrase Islamic terrorism, that it's a huge deal? No.
Depression frees the Christian from the illusion that they can do everything themselves. Well, honestly, that puts you in a great position to hear the gospel.
This performance-based Christianity, you know, it's not sustaining. I mean, you can do that for a while if your life is really good, but when your life falls down around you, you need the comfort that only comes from the gospel.
Nebraska runners love Issues Etc.
We have been through the philosophy classroom, heard there the sometimes stated, sometimes merely assumed assertions that are made early on in Philosophy 101 that challenge and tend to, at least attempt to, undermine the Christian mind and the Christian faith. We went on to the biology classroom. A lot of discussion there about the presuppositions regarding neo-Darwinian evolution that does the same thing to the Christian mind and the Christian faith. Could there be challenges to the Christian mind and faith in the English literature classroom, English Lit 101, opening that classroom door and stepping in? Can a Christian expect, and should a Christian be prepared for, challenges there? Welcome back to Issues Etc., coming to you live from the studios of Lutheran Public Radio in Collinsville, Illinois. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to step into that classroom, English Lit 101, in part three of our series on classroom apologetics. Dr. Christian Kopp will join us to give us some of the challenges that are there. These are subtle, but they are there, and a response to them. Then a little bit later, it'll be time for listener email. Your email to us will respond, and the Issues Etc. comment line. You can join us with questions or comments. By the way, that comment line number, 618-223-8382, open anytime, day or night. Our regular call-in number, 1-877-623-6943. Our email address, talkback@issuesetc.org, and our Twitter address, @issuesetc. Dr. Christian Kopp is a regular guest. He's Associate Professor of Classics at the University of Colorado and author of the book, The Devil Knows Latin, Why America Needs the Classical Tradition. Dr. Kopp, welcome to Issues Etc.
Great to be here.
Merely as a subject in the pantheon of education, what should be the goal of teaching English literature, and how has that goal been changed?
Yes, it's a very good question. The purpose of literature courses, and even if it's not English literature but some other, should be to learn how to read the great stories embodied in works of high literary merit, and then to respond to those stories in your own language, your own articulate, clear way. So it's a twofold thing. You're reading, you're learning both things about the book and about the culture behind it, and then also you should be able to respond to what you've learned yourself in an articulate and clear way.
And how has that goal changed?
The goal now is, teaching has always involved elements of enculturation. That is, you not only learn to read a story, you also learn things about your culture and about the culture that produced the works you're reading. And now enculturation has sort of taken over as the primary purpose. Notice it was always one of the purposes. But now we've moved on from really, therefore you don't have to really read great stories or great works of literature to find out what you should about the way you should behave and the kind of person you should be and the kind of world you should support politically and socially.
So let's talk about some of the things, kind of take that last answer apart a little bit and talk about some of the things that a student is going to encounter, presuppositions, some of them stated, some of them unstated, in the average English Lit 101 class. You say the way that ancient literature is taught generally is going to view Christianity, as you say, as an aberration. What do you mean by that?
Well, here's the problem, especially if we look at from the Middle Ages through virtually just the other day. I mean, I'm T.S. Eliot, and these are the great figures, Tolkien, these are the great figures. Christianity is central to these figures. He's central. Christianity is central to Dante, central to Shakespeare, central to Milton. I don't want to go on forever. Central to T.S. Eliot, central to very, certainly very important to Tolkien. I guess we could debate central. And therefore, you need to learn why that doesn't matter. We used to have a teacher here who taught in the Great Books program, and she gave a fantastic lecture on Dante, in which she explained that Christianity was sort of a psychological, cultural phenomenon of Dante, and that getting what you needed out of Dante was to learn the psychological insight into the figures he presented. That's why Hell and Purgatory was so much more interesting than Heaven, because you saw real people confronted by real emotional life situations, and the religion was there to provide a background to it. It was a beautiful stained glass window, but the real action was the individual person responding to temptation, to anger, to lust, all the things that you see. And it was a fantastic lecture explaining why you didn't have to know Christianity or take it seriously to enjoy Dante. Mm. And it was wonderful because it was so explicit.
Now, that seems to be a little anachronistic. I imagine if you consulted with Dante himself, he might consider Christianity part and parcel of his famous works.
I think that when you look at, certainly to name just three of the figures I mentioned, the case of Dante and Milton, we know that Christianity was the center, that was what it grew out of, and then they learned how to do, you know, taking the traditions of Christianity, and by the way, the traditions of the ancient world, too, which they both knew very well, Dante and Milton, and you could say that about Shakespeare and T.S. Eliot, too, and taking them and creating something new and vital and exciting that linked to the past religiously, ethically, and aesthetically. And to tell people, look, you need to view Dante the way you would read a modern mystery novel, where it's the psychology of the murderer and the psychology of the policeman or the private detective that matters, not their religion, is to absolutely undo what the author thought was the most important thing.
So what becomes of a piece of literature under study when religion, and in particular Christianity, as much as it is an element, is just dismissed? What becomes of that literature? What do you get out of Dante or Dickens or anyone else?
It increasingly, you begin to look mainly for the aesthetic elements. And by the way, this is part of teaching literature. So it's not that they're totally false to their mission. You look at design, you look at structure, you look at vocabulary. If you're getting to that level, you look at meter. You look at all the traits that a great writer uses to get across the ethical and religious insight that is the center of the vision. And you then leave out what is at the heart of things. It's like going to a great painting and discussing color and design and all the rest of it and never actually talking about what it's a painting of.
So is it evenly applied, this standard here, to all religions, or is Christianity in some sense in the modern English literature classroom singled out?
Well, it's singled out because the real history of English literature, and I think Tolkien showed this goes even back to Beowulf, where Christianity is not mentioned in the character's actions. The author clearly knows Christianity and refers to it. But Christianity is central to English literature basically as early back as we can go. And it continues the really influential works that people love to read and are fascinated by. And produce the plays. We have a Shakespeare Festival here every summer at the University of Colorado Boulder. This has been one of the key guiding threads that has made sense out of English literature and the way English literature connects and reconnects over the centuries. And by removing this, what you have is a jumble of more or less randomly selected works, and that's why there's always this big debate on the canon. Because without Christianity, the canon is just a meaningless list of, you know, what's your favorite Kiefer Sutherland movie or something. It's there's no real integral connection between these works. With Christianity, there's an integral connection all the way from 1066 on to the modern contemporary world.
Another presupposition that's been introduced into the English Literature 101 classroom, you say, is that ethics and morality are understood to evolve. The concerns in great literature from the past about those things are fetishes or obsessions. No real insight into the human condition. Talk about that, if you would.
Well, increasingly, even though certainly there's a lot of talk about society and social norms and things like that, but the basic premise is taken to be the individual alone, the individual without social garb, the religion with the individual without religion, and the individual who creates his or her own morality. And even though I think it's pretty hard to find an existentialist in the philosophy department nowadays, you can certainly find them in the English department, because this obsession with the individual apart from, and so you study a work like Hamlet, which is all about a religion, moral obligation, the conflict between religion and revenge, all these kinds of things, and instead it becomes a psychological study in a disturbed young college student who's having difficulty adjusting to his mother's remarriage after the death of his father. Now, that is in fact an element of Hamlet, but it's, you know, the way Shakespeare tells the story in the play, that is the least. There is a part of a soliloquy that goes on a little bit about it. It's all about what are my obligations in this moral situation, religious, ethical, family. And it's not about an individual. And they turn a play that's about a real important decision that, although we don't have to deal with a specific one, we all have to deal with conflict between our religious beliefs and the ethics of our society. And it makes it a psychological study in depression. It was called melancholy back then in the 16th century. And it's depression. And you'll even see people, bring in visiting speakers from the psychology department to talk about depression. And then, of course, you can relate to your students because, they're away from home and their girlfriend has dropped them or something. And so they all know what depression is. But that's not the heart of Hamlet, even though it is, by the way, a part of Hamlet.
So, again, it sounds like the literature itself is pulled from its context, not only its context when it was written, but its greater kind of eternal truths context.
Yes, no, that's hitting the nail right on the head. As I mentioned, studying the great works of literature tradition is partly about enculturation, and this is a deculturation. As a matter of fact, there have been over the past generation some rather interesting Marxist analyses to try to get people to take the history seriously again, because Marxism needs history and economic development and all the rest of these things to function, and they've been frustrated looking at this, turning everything into an individual psychological problems and taking away the coherent cultural context of the work, and then, if you get far enough along, how that cultural context relates to where we are today.
And does it also rob it of its, I'm trying to search for a word here, Dr. Kopp, but it's transcultural application.
Yeah, the point of, yes, I mean, it's simply the point of getting to know other cultures. And here's this interesting thing. We're all supposed to have people in our schools from all over the place who are going to teach us about other cultures. But we also have the development of our culture exemplified in great works of literature telling archetypical stories, primal stories, and getting to know these people, understanding why would Chaucer think that? Why would a character in Hamlet think that? Why does Milton view this as important? Why does Jane Austen have that response, and why does she find that funny? These are all parts of getting to know another world and getting to see how much richer our world can be when we take seriously great writers talking about great, significant issues.
Dr. Richard Kopp is our guest, Associate Professor of Classics at the University of Colorado, author of the book, The Devil Knows Latin, Why America Needs the Classical Tradition. He had mentioned something about pure aesthetics. We'll talk about that after this. Are you looking for Christmas cards that combine beautiful art with a clear Christian confession? Emmanuel Press offers Christ-centered, affordable cards in a variety of designs. You'll find cards with stained glass, illumination, German frescoes, and other unique artwork found only at Emmanuel Press. Visit their website, emmanuelpress.us, emmanuelpress.us.
Memoria Press invites all Issues Etc. listeners to explore our Simply Classical curriculum, a set of full-year academic curriculum packages for children with learning challenges. Our classical writing program and our Christian studies are now based on your favorite CPH Bible storybooks. To learn more, visit classicalspecialneeds.com and use promo code LPR to save on your initial purchase. That's classicalspecialneeds.com.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
At Concordia University Irvine, you can pursue advanced theological study for academic, professional, or personal development. Concordia's Master of Arts in Theology program is grounded in the truth of Scripture and insights from the Lutheran Confessions. Courses are taught online and at intensive on-campus sessions in the summer. Apologetics, Christian education leadership, and Reformation studies are just a few of the emphases offered. For more information, visit cui.edu/theology.
Lutheran Talk.
In Lutheranism, I come as a guilty sinner in need of hearing the forgiving words of Christ every single time I gather. Every single time.
Lutheran music. The new Lutheran Public Radio app. Download for iPhone, Android, Windows Phone, and Kindle at issuesetc.org.
It's part three of our series, Classroom Apologetics. Today we are in the English Literature 101 classroom with Dr. Christian Kopf, Associate Professor of Classics at the University of Colorado. If you're enjoying our new series, Classroom Apologetics, please consider joining the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. It's our monthly or annual donor program. And if you join in October, we'll send you a limited edition Here I Stand long sleeve t-shirt along with the other membership benefits. You can find out more and join at issuesetc.org. Click the picture of Martin Luther posting the 95 Theses or make your check payable to Issues Etc. and send it to Issues Etc. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Please write Reformation Club in the memo line of your check. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. The Issues Etc. Reformation Club. Before the break, you were talking about how the study of great literature of the past can, in the modern English Lit 101 classroom, be reduced to mere aesthetic appreciation. What do you mean by that?
There's a lot of work done on this. English does it a little bit less than it did a while ago. But there's still very much, since you can't talk about the great ethical issues, you don't even mention religion if you can help it. Every once in a while it pops up anyhow. So you start talking about the details of how Shakespeare structures the work, are there five acts or not, or what about the fact that scenes end with rhyming couplets, what about imagery, lots of stuff on imagery, why does he do this imagery and that imagery. These are all, of course, things that are significant. They're not central, but they're significant in making sense of what the author wants to get across. But then that becomes the sole concentration of the work, and you've left the work just to be sort of a pretty bauble that you hang on your wall or, you know, put on your desk, not a central part of your emotional life and your intellectual life and your religious life.
It seems to me that the aesthetic elements of good English literature simply cannot be appreciated fully apart from the content, from the, as you say, kind of the substance of the thing rather than merely the structure or the beauty of the thing.
When a work is well done, the central theme leads to the aesthetic additions and developments. That is, they're not really additions. They do come integrally out of what is important, but they are to this degree secondary, that they're ways to help you see better what the author is trying to get across, instead of being something that you concentrate to the exclusion of what mattered most to the author.
talk about the tendency in the study of English literature to deconstruct things. What, first of all, what does that mean, and how is it done, and what's its outcome?
Well, this again is an extreme development of a good idea. You want to think critically. Critical thinking is important as part of an education. It's the second of the classical education trivia: grammar, logic, and rhetoric. And we want our students to be able to think clearly and to question what they have. But what has happened is there has to be a mutual interaction of listening to the author, who here is another person, as it were, and responding positively, and then also being able to think, hold on a second, you know, should Hamlet have done that? Why is what Elizabeth Bennet did not wise? I mean, the whole set of questions you can ask is the Satan who makes such a wonderful speech in Paradise Lost 1, is his rhetoric really insightful, or is it sort of crazy, really? You want to be able to do that, but what they've done is insist that all works are sort of elements of power of a culture imposing itself on the innocent soul that reads it. And the first obligation of the reader is the aesthetics of suspicion, in which instead of after you've read and appreciated and loved the work, you then think, are there issues here? How do I respond? It becomes the sole design of the class, is to show up the work, that all these works that Milton is just propagandizing for his Puritan regime, and Faulkner is just defending his segregationist regime, and you absolutely don't get any feeling of the love that's at the heart of the work at the expense of only, and I don't, critical thinking is good, but of only responding critically to great works of literature.
How does the abuse of reader response figure into this being read by the text kind of a thing? There's an element of truth there, isn't there?
Yeah, the great thing, of course, and this is true also of heresies in religion, right? There is a truth behind all the heresies. It's taken out of context and then blown up into the whole thing. And here, it's especially clear in the case of drama that the response of the audience is important. And I once heard a story of a guy who was so rich that he rented a theater to watch a comedy by himself, and he didn't want to be bothered by the other people. The problem is, part of a comedy is people laughing, of people enjoying it. And that's also true of a great tragedy, and to hear people moved, to feel people moved in an audience. That is also true, mutatis mutandis, changing things we have to change, of works of lyric poetry, of epic, of novels, etc. So that's the truth that lies behind it. But the problem we've had with the reader response is that the reader's response becomes the work. We also see this develop into what in Europe is called reception studies, and you'll sometimes reception history. You'll see this in our country too, where there basically is no Dante, there's no Milton, there's no Shakespeare. There's the way they were received or understood by the reader. And that is the only reality. And that, of course, makes the critic and the reader the paradigm for understanding the work, the importance of the work, and the author and the work itself become secondary. And then again, you can start reading all kinds of mediocre stuff in class, because the point is how you respond to it, not the work itself.
So that kind of leads to the final point that I wanted you to discuss here, and that is literature being treated as mere amusement or excitement, entertainment, fun. Explain that, if you would.
So many people have grown up in the culture, who are readers, by the way, a lot of people don't read, who are readers, have grown up in a culture where, where's my latest favorite, Twilight book or Jack Reacher book or all the rest of these things, where reading is purely to pass time when you're stuck in the, on the tarmac at O'Hare waiting for your plane to take off or whatever it is. And there's no serious investment in the work. And great works of literature take hold of you and make you respond with both love and sometimes embarrassment and change your life. There are people whose lives have been changed by reading Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment, people whose lives have been changed by reading Tolkien. And this is something that, for so many people, the lesson they learn, I don't mean that any individual in the English department teaches this explicitly, but the lesson they learn is ignore the religion, ignore the ethics, ignore just the fact that this is enjoyable and I had a good time, and literature becomes solely a form of entertainment to done while you're relaxing from your serious job of doing scientific research, the only serious work that can be done. No teacher ever taught a student that explicitly. No one ever wrote that on a blackboard or handed it out in a handout for the student to read. But you teach them that by teaching them that the great themes, the great life-changing themes of literature are not only secondary, they're not even discussed. And literature then inevitably comes for us, many bright readers, just a form of entertainment and a way to pass the time.
Finally, then, you mentioned earlier in our conversation the importance of reading and studying, as you said, works of high literary merit. How do you respond to someone, and I'm sure you've heard it before, who says, look, there is no objective standard for determining works of high literary merit. It's all subjective. How do you respond?
Well, yes, we have this about beauty, too. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Beauty isn't objective. Great works of literature. I happen to like some kinds of graphic novels, as they now call my students tell me I should call comic books. Now, the fact is, there are many works that are fun and exciting, like Treasure Island, let's say, which actually are works of high literary merit. It's true they were written for kids, but that doesn't mean they aren't works of high literary merit. So it is a tricky question, but this is where the issue of taking tradition seriously is part. Tradition is smarter than any one of us, smarter than any group of us, smarter than any generation. It tells you what laws make sense and what don't, what ethical attitudes make sense and what don't, and it tells you about works of literature. And the fact that people have been, you know, reading and moved by Job and by Virgil's Aeneid and by the Antigone and by Dante and, you know, Shakespeare, there is an objective validity given us by tradition, which gives us the wisdom of thousands of years in some of the works I've mentioned, hundreds of years in others. And that is an objective reality. And it's just that many modern works and many works of those times haven't survived or been interesting is itself the sign of so many minds working together in response. So tradition is a source of objective knowledge. It is in ethics, and it is in literature.
Finally, then, what's the best piece of advice that you can give to students to who are going to study English literature to stand by and to defend their Christian beliefs while in that English Lit 101 class?
It'll start with the fact you notice the teacher skipping over the religious part. Right? Hamlet is confronted by a praying Claudius and wonders whether he should take his revenge on him. And he gives reasons why he shouldn't. And then he goes away and Claudius stands up and himself gives religious reasons why Hamlet's arguments were faulty. And usually that's skipped right over. Let's skip this scene. It's not important. Hamlet just is too neurotic to do anything. Over and over again, or else what the teacher will do is, well, you know, this refers to a passage in the Bible. Let's go on to the aesthetic scene or the sexual sequence, and notice those things. They're important. They're giveaways. They show how central religion in general and the Christian faith in particular is to the great works of English literature. And think about them. You should certainly take seriously what your teacher tells you, and should certainly write a paper that the teacher will enjoy. But remember, it's your education. You need to be knowledgeable and thoughtful and moved by this. And of course, if the teacher explicitly attacks the faith, and the great helpful thing there is at least they're showing you where they're coming from. The harder thing is when the teacher just ignores it. And that is also a way of attacking the faith.
Dr. Christian Kopf is associate professor of classics at the University of Colorado and author of the book, The Devil Knows Latin, Why Americans Need the Classical Tradition. You'll find a link to this book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Dr. Kopf, thank you very much.
It's been great talking to you.
We'll be going through your email and your comments on the Issues Etc. comment line on this Wednesday afternoon, October the 5th, right after the break.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House. Listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
Join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club in October, and we'll send you a limited edition Here I Stand t-shirt. Find out more about our monthly or annual giving program at issuesetc.org. Just click the picture of Martin Luther posting the 95 Theses, or call Craig 618-223-8385. Join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club by Reformation Day, and we'll send you a limited edition long sleeve shirt along with your other membership benefits. The Issues Etc. Reformation Club.
The 500th anniversary of the Reformation approaches. A good time to ask, who are we as Confessional Lutherans? What's our heritage? The Confessional Lutherans for Christ Commission has produced the Layman's Guide to Theological History. Go to the CLCC.org and see which of these presentations and books would be most helpful to you and your fellow parishioners. And consider becoming a member with us as the CLCC seeks to help more people know what it means to be a Confessional Lutheran. The CLCC.org.
No gimmicks, no shticks, just straightforward preaching and teaching in accord with Scripture and the Lutheran confessions. By the book liturgy, right from the hymnal. No glitz, just Christ crucified for sinners like us. We're Grace Lutheran Church in Racine, Wisconsin. Come receive God's gifts with us. Find out more about us at gracelutheranracine, that's all one word, .net. And like you, we're proud supporters of Issues Etc.
Old theology, new technology. You're listening to Issues Etc.
We Lutherans were never aided by following along with some other tradition's theological priorities and catchphrases.
Issues Etc. regular guest, Pastor Heath Curtis, coordinator for stewardship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod on a Lutheran approach to stewardship.
Other folks are not approaching it from our good, solid Lutheran understanding of law and gospel and vocation. There's a place to talk about this in Christianity, and we have a way of talking about stewardship as Lutherans without ever using the word stewardship, if you like. I'm going to talk to you today about your vocation in your home, in your church, in your society, and how each one of these makes a claim on you, on your presence, on your support, on your prayers. That's how we should talk about this as Lutherans.
You'll find several stewardship resources at lcms.org/stewardship, lcms.org/stewardship.